You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world. You're listening to Dr. Michelle Live. Dr. Michelle is a Catholic psychiatrist. However, the views and opinions presented by Dr. Michelle are by no means medical advice. Please consult your doctor for official medical guidance.
Welcome. I am your host, Dr. Michelle. You're walking with me today on Dr. Michelle Live. You're welcome to call and weigh in and text 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. You can be anonymous, and you can also be even more anonymous if you like, and email me, dmlive@breadboxmedia.com. Today, we are going to talk to... No, we're not talking to. We're talking about the lonely life of being different. Today, this week has been the week of the child, and we started off talking about the diagnosis of autistic spectrum and how that has affected members of my own family, what I think about it, or the different ways I think about it. You have to be your own anthropologist. This is my theme. Be your own anthropologist and don't let something be limiting, because people can see, like you. You make all kinds of assumptions every day about the people that you see at the store, at the church, at the school, at your job, at your prayer groups, at your friend circles, everything. You make assumptions. Everybody you know on Facebook, well, it's a known problem now, is that we make assumptions just by snapshots, by these little tiny fabricated moments of reality. So how do you have a fabricated moment of reality? Well, like anything else, I know you've been there, because I've been there, where I have seen a picture. I remember that of the Alamo. I've seen a picture, and you to a place you've never been, you go, oh my gosh, I want to go. And because you make an assumption by seeing the picture. Now, the picture could be taken at the tip of a pie shape angle that might be 2 feet by 3 feet, but you've got an entire fantasy laid out, including what you're going to look like in the picture, what the picture is like, who are the people that live, populate this amazing, magical area, what the food is like, how the birds are singing. And really it could be in the middle of a landfill, or at the edge of a landfill. And I have done myself, and when I said the Alamo, I remember having to go to San Antonio. And for anyone in San Antonio, it's an awesome place. But going to San Antonio, Texas, and of course, having been brought up in the West, but I'd never been to San Antonio, I was just aching for some westernness, you know, western history, just aching for it, like, oh, I gotta find it. And because it was hard to find it anywhere, even in the West. So there's this picture of the Alamo, and I just, you know, you remember all those old spaghetti westerns, I used to call them, of the old West movies that were actually made in Italy because it was cheaper and the terrain was better, they would make dubbed movies that were Westerns, but done in Italy. So you'd have that kind of deserty looking terrain and the coastal deserty, the same kind of weather patterns. And so I'm looking at this brochure thinking, this is going to be so great. I even want to add a few days onto my conference, because the Alamo just looks so amazing. And the Riverwalk looks so beautiful. I thought, now there's a place. My gosh, look what they've done. They're so proud of their heritage, and they preserved not only the heritage, but they've also grown around it rather than pulverized it and then put up something ugly. They've got this beautiful river walk, which it is beautiful, and it's very long. And so, so I was all excited. So I go to the conference at this great big conference center, and sure enough, the river is absolutely beautiful and the restaurants on it. And it's just so nice and enjoyable. The weather's great, but it doesn't really last that long. There's not a lot of, you know, you extrapolate out, there's going to be hills and all kinds of landscape and trees. And no, it was just like in the middle of any place USA. And so here was this beautiful, but it's beautiful. Don't get me wrong. It's beautiful. And there are a lot of places. I've lived in a place where they have a beautiful river, but because it was the railway system of the time, or the waterway was the mode of transport, then the main roads, but they built the freeway, like literally on the, all along the river. So you could not partake in the river or sit and watch the river unless you were underneath the freeway. And that was not very conducive to just idly, you know, sitting by and watching nature, because it was drowned out by all the cars. So the whole point of this is that we look at things. So I go here to Texas, and Texas is awesome. And I love it. But what I had in my mind, and what I had also once I walked, I thought, well, then I'll go see the Alamo too. So I start walking from this big conference center to see the Alamo. And I go through block after block after block of nice and pretty downtown with big, very nice buildings, very architecturally enjoyable to look at, very clean, very pleasant and pleasantly placed streets, but Banana Republic and The Gap and McDonald's and all this. So I'm going, where in the world is the Alamo? And so I'm going all over the place. And finally, I asked somebody, I'm looking for the Alamo. And they pointed and they said, just, you know, turn left here. And there was like this little, it almost looked like a tiny city park. And way at the end of the tiny city park was a little tent. And there was some man in a military of the day outfit, a period outfit. And then there was like a little wall and then a tiny little thing. And that was the Alamo. And of course, I was expecting the Alamo. I don't know what I was expecting, but my mind had already painted in all the other parts. And that's what we do with each other. We see a snapshot and we paint in all the other parts. You know who I am. I know who you are sometimes just by looking at a picture. And we do throw the baby out with the bathwater all the time by saying, you know, you can't judge a book by its cover. That came before the whole 60s revolution of it doesn't matter what you look like and you're not defined by your name. And it just kind of went the other way. But of course, it's great when you have faded cutoff jeans and you're tan and you're 15 and you have, you know, a bathing suit top and a surfboard, or you have, you know, long hair and beads or whatever it was of the 60s. But of the 60s, if you happen to want to just jump right in to that whole lifestyle of being free and easy and not defined by other people, and you were wearing the early days of the stiff, unworldly, unnatural polyester pants that were all these weird neon colors or not found in nature, with elastic waistband and some other kind of synthetic shirt that symbolized something else, you'd be ostracized. You wouldn't just fit into the free and easy crowd, because the free and easy crowd had their uniform. So we're just like that. Can guarantee you, we go to a place, I'll set up a little tent, you walk in that little tent, and there's a bunch of people that look a certain way of a certain age group that have white coats on with stethoscopes across your neck. There's going to be a whole lot of people who aren't going to ask any questions. They're going to just assume it's a little medical tent. Likewise, if they had straggly hair, lots of tattoos, and a few guitars and some cigarettes going, you're going to assume that they're musicians. And the reverse could be true. We could reverse them. It could be the musicians that we dressed up in the white coats, and it could be the doctors we put with all the guitars and scraggled up their hair a bit. And, you know, and that's the reality. We all know that that can happen. It happens all the time. It used to happen in this hospital I worked at, actually, one of the ancillary groups, which were very important and fundamental, but they were, I think, social workers, which are great. But they're the person that they was in charge of them, had them all dress in long white coats, much like was symbolic of the physician of the time. And they would go into the emergency room because they would have to take the first interview. And 9 times out of 10, the person who just comes taken into the emergency room sees somebody walk in a white coat. They think they're a doctor. They make all the, a physician. So they make all these assumptions. And I remember one guy saying, look, I'm a doctor of divinity. I'm not a doctor of anything. I'm a doctor of divinity, but he told me to wear this white coat and I'm really uncomfortable because that person thinks I'm a physician. So the reality is there's nobody's right or wrong in this, except for the man lacked a little insight who was in charge of everybody because he didn't understand, or maybe he did. Maybe he didn't care that people were going to misunderstand. He wasn't empathetic to the human being who is going to be witnessing that. So the whole point of this to say all these different areas I'm talking to you about, whether it's a travel brochure or whether it's looking at somebody in a tent with a white coat, we make judgments and we fill in the blanks. We write the narrative of their lives and their stories. Thus goes the way of you. Thus goes the way of you to yourself, who you should and shouldn't be, because you want to write the narrative that you see coming at you from other people. And then thus goes your children. So this is the week of the child. And we were talking about this spectrum, this autistic spectrum, that when you do catch it, it's fabulous. You need to. But I want to look at the fullness of it. Let's look at the whole picture. And today we have we're going to kind of go around the concept of you just can't make a shoe fit if it doesn't fit. And I want to introduce you to an article that of someone who's very famous, and very accomplished and very rich, who has mental illness, and also to someone who was written about in the New York Times, who has Asperger's and what kind of life they have and some of the talents that come out of this person that you would never think of. So I am Dr. Michelle. We're going to open up, get your coffee, take a stretch, breathe the air, and we will see you on the other side of the break.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world. You're listening to Dr. Michelle Live. Dr. Michelle is a Catholic psychiatrist. However, the views and opinions presented by Dr. Michelle are by no means medical advice. Please consult your doctor for official medical guidance.
Welcome back. I am your host, Dr. Michelle, and you are walking with me today on Dr. Michelle Live, 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. And you know, when you try to make that shoe fit, it doesn't work. I know. And ladies, you know, because how many of you have crammed that old foot into some shoe or drowned in a shoe because you like the shoe? And you know it's just going to look awesome. Or you see someone else who's worn the shoe and you think, oh, I got to have that for my outfit, no matter how it hurts or how you trip because it's too big for you. And we try to do that all the time. But what happens when you do it to yourself and that shoe is the outside world and the label they put on you? And how about when you do it with your kids? Because we think that's what we need to do. It is no different than the drive for your child and your children to survive. So we look at this as a survival thing. You want your children to fit in because in the animal world, we're not animals. I'm not saying we are. I do not say we are animals because we are not animals. We're not. I think that my dog is much smarter than me in a lot of ways. But we do survive. And one way we survive is in packs. And as I told you yesterday, in tribes and societies and everything else. And what I told you yesterday is a reality. There are places right here, right now, where if you have a Down syndrome child or you have a child who has some kind of special need, you can be ostracized and rebuked and actually cut off from your entire tribe, your entire neighborhood, your entire little small culture, because that's kind of infecting the group in their own ignorant way of thinking, let's put it that way. Because that particular a time when that particular person would not survive on their own, and they would take the scarce resources from the mouths of the, you know, the other people, and there you have it. So we have had a very rough and survival of the fittest in a lot of ways. And as we learned, and the mental was right along with the physical, we found a way, we as humanity found a way to connect the dots so that, yes, it is a matter of who can run, who can eat, who can, but then also who can outwit, who can stay safe, who can keep theirs safe, who can find the best cave. What's wrong with this cave? Why don't we have one right by the water? You know, somebody put it together. The water comes up and it can drown everybody while they're sleeping. So let's try to find a different one. And the people who didn't come, I mean, this is all very simplistic and it probably didn't happen this way, but it's the way I look at it. So then as we get more and we can develop more, in other words, what did we have to have? We had to have good eyesight. We had to have, humanity had to have these things to stay on the planet and not get eaten by other beings or by succumb to the elements or succumb to poison plants. You had to have somebody who said, oh, don't eat that plant. They may not have understood why. And then someone else 500 years later might say, I wonder why. What's in that plant? How come I can eat this plant that looks even weirder and it's an eggplant, but I can't eat that pretty plant over there because we die. And so someone starts figuring it out. We start liking the brain. We start finding out how to build stuff and warming ourselves. So we have more time and more ability and more need to function and grow our intellects and our and put those and discover these things. And it's just, it's a beautiful plan in life. So here we are now, not much different. We want our children to survive. We want our children to do better than we did. We want them accepted by the group. We don't want them to be complete conformists, many of us, but we want them to have their place where they feel secure and they're not turned down for jobs. They're not turned down for college, not laughed at out of school. They're not crying at night in their pillows. They're not looked at like they need to be locked away. This is what we desire for our children. I did that for my own child, who is so brilliant and is helping so many people now in a very high two very high level positions. He's helping hundreds of thousands of people every single day. And yet there was a time where I just kind of wished he was more normal, whatever normal was. I didn't even know what normal was, but not that I didn't love him. I did. And I loved his unusualness, but I saw that the part of him that desired and wanted a certain connection at times didn't always have the one he wanted because he himself didn't quite fit. And he would meet that one pink poppy like himself in that sea of white poppies. And they would just be unusual together, whether they were two little five-year-olds in kindergarten talking about neuroscience or whether they were, you know, whatever it was. And because to him, it was, he had a different way of thinking. And we want to, and we keep saying as a culture, we're going to celebrate. But then we keep narrowing the window of what that even means. So today, I'm going to give you two links today. One of them is in this lovely op-ed piece that I found from the New York Times today called Perfectly Normal. And it, Perfectly Normal. And it was put together and it goes to a little video, but there's a whole article by this, I don't know how to say the name. It's by Joris Dabiji. And it was put in yesterday. And it's wonderful. It's about a man with Asperger's. Now they don't talk about Asperger's syndrome that much. They put it into people who display this particular characteristics and what they would concern, say, learning disabilities and things like that. They've now taken the Asperger's, even though it's still a syndrome. We used to diagnose and work with people all the time. Now you don't hear that so much because it's in the autistic spectrum. And again, you know, I told you about that autistic spectrum because the people that are looking at it, I'm wondering, how much of the spectrum are you looking at? Are you looking at the ultraviolet and are you looking at the infrared? Or are you only looking at the visible color? And see, even me saying that probably puts me in some weird place. So this is really beautiful, though. It is very beautiful. Not only is this man, when you look at him, which I hope you do, it's only like 8 minutes. Not only is this man, you see the place that he lives, and none of you are going to say, hey, that's just where I want to live. You see that his girlfriend, but it's not just touching because they're so out there. You hear him, you hear what he says. And to me, the beauty and the brilliance of that part of the spectrum that I can't always see, I'm able to see. It's like putting on night vision goggles or having something filter so you can see the ultraviolet or the infrared. It's absolutely like when you see infrared lights that they use now for sprays and beauty, that's not infrared. You're seeing a colored light they're putting on top of it because itself is not a visible red. So it's infrared. Okay. So, you get to see the workings into my odd mind. But what I want to bring home is all these differences, all these parts of you really want to look at spectrum. Sometimes it can be very lonely. Gifted children sometimes, that oftentimes are lonely children. So gifted, autistic, brave, putting your children into one particular group, shy, introverted. Is there a difference? It's trying to just say we need to have this kind of child and he looks like this way because that's the way all my friends look. Somebody I know was diagnosing a child, and yes, you can. That can give you a tip off. Little things can give you tip offs. And I've done it myself in social situations where there was just one little tweak of an odd behavior other people weren't picking up on. And I would take the parent aside that I knew well, and I would say, I could be very wrong, but I'm seeing something and I want you to check it out. And it turns out they would have a diagnosis. So yes, but that's also not always the best thing to do. You have to really, really, you know, kind of really couch things a bit. But so let me do three things. One, I'm going to read you an article from a very famous man who suffers from a mental illness. And he's very famous. He's very rich. He's very known. He's been around a long time. He's written books, made movies. He's a comedian. He's an actor. He's a writer. He's all kinds of stuff. I want to tell you a little bit about his childhood and about his mental illness. I want to talk a little bit about this op-ed piece from the New York Times that is just beautiful. And I've got the link called Perfectly Normal. And I also want to finish up with the 6 things you didn't know about gifted kids, because this also preludes, you know, which part of the spectrum do you or your children lay? And I want you to remember that gifted doesn't mean that you can understand, and it doesn't mean you can't understand. It just means that your snapshot of the child who is privileged in the way that they're able to utilize all resources, that they probably fit in well because they are smart and they appear to converse in such a reasonable manner, you would expect them to live a certain way. Sometimes they can be some of the most misunderstood children because they have what we talked about as the asynchronous development. And so they're developing at different places at different times, anywhere along the line. So you have to understand that they just don't go to everyday normal school and just excel. Sometimes they actually do worse. They flunk out. They stare off. They're misdiagnosed as autistic or OCD or ADHD because they can't sit still in their seats. Or they might be more interested in how things are working and they're observing the interaction between the teachers and the students and not doing any of their work. Lots of these things play into it. So we're going to spend the rest of the show on these 3 things. Please get your coffee, get your juice, look out the window, take a breath, and we will resume our walk on the other side of the break.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world. You're listening to Dr. Michelle Live. Dr. Michelle is a Catholic psychiatrist. However, the views and opinions presented by Dr. Michelle are by no means medical advice. Please consult your doctor for official medical guidance.
welcome. Welcome, welcome back. I hope that you've had a chance to take a breath and settle into the thought that you are now charged with being your own anthropologist into the culture of your life and your family. This is something that is way too important and way too awesome. And I'll have another program about how broken families sometimes can interrupt our anthropological understandings. And so we make mistakes, because I can look at family members that I know and I've seen and I saw as children, and I can say, wait a minute, in the family member who was diagnosed with the autistic spectrum, I would say, look at this person who's now 55 years old. Do you know when they were a child, the stories are, this is what they did. They only stared at the pulleys up while all the other kids are having a grand old time. They're only staring at the pulleys of a musical, or they didn't seem to react the way other children did, or they were the one that pointed out. They would just sit there and stare, and then they would say something like, you know, that door is open, or on some huge building. They would just, that just how their brains were, but yet they weren't, they functioned in life, they functioned well, and they end up going to school, they end up getting careers, and they just lived a normal life. So I'm reminded, though, I was sent something this morning where, which was awesome. It's 1 John, 1 John, 3:2. And it says, "Dear friends, we are already God's children, but he has not yet shown us what he will be." I'm sorry, I'm going to start over because I messed it up. "Dear friends, we are already God's children, but he has not yet shown us what we will be like when Christ appears. But we do not know that we will be like him." I am so messing this up. Okay. "But we do know that we will be like him, for we will see him as he really is." I just now decided I was going to stick that in, so that's why I kind of messed it up. But so what does this say to me today? It's so beautiful. But this Christ was our, we are in Lent. You know, I should probably remind myself of that. We are in Lent. And Christ was like the biggest misfit in the world, and he was crucified, right? He was adulated, crucified, depending on which Facebook snapshot he was in at the time. What group was looking at him? One group looks at him, he's the king. Next minute, next group looks at him, he's God. He's God. He is the Son of Man. He is God. The next group looks at him, and he's just a rabble-rousing charlatan. So this is very beautiful, but it also is something we can take an example from. "Dear friends, we are already God's children, but he has not yet shown us what we will be like when Christ appears." That means we can't see all of what we are, and we can't see all of what the other person is, our neighbor, our son, our daughter, our husband, our wife, our friend, our mother, father, lover. We can't see that. But we do know that we will be like him, for we will see him as he really is. Can you imagine that day, that day that we will actually see each other how we really are? I mean, to me, what purgatory or pain that must be before you can actually see God, because we will see not just the people we judge, but the people we didn't even think we judged. And we'll see what's really in them. And we will be humbled on our knees. And I know you've had this. I've had people tell me, you know, make so many judgments about me. It's unbelievable. And some people will say, you know, "My gosh, you're so intense. I can't even be in your presence more than 2 minutes." And other people say, "You're so calm. You make me so calm." And it's like, I'm thinking, wow, these are like two really bizarre different opinions. And I'm pretty much just me. So you never know. So when we look at whether it's a gifted child being gifted in that they have extraordinary capabilities, or whether it's someone who has extraordinary capabilities, but also a house that has a lot of brokenness in it too, we have to be very open to the fact that if it's us, you have to be open to your own self, because you don't know who you really are inside. And with your own children, we cannot, we don't have the illumination of God to look inside that skull, inside that brain, inside that heart, inside that soul, and see the powerhouse of potential, the powerhouse of reality, the powerhouse of an amazing universe opening up in inside that human being. So real quickly, because I am going to run out of time again, going quickly over this gifted article, six things you think you understood about gifted kids but don't. I probably should put that link up too. Alex, please remind me. When they talk about that, we all assume gifted kids are going to excel in school, and they don't always. Sometimes they are way more, they might have a learning disability. Can you believe that? Yes, they can. A learning disability. And it may go unnoticed because they compensate so well, but they may have trouble. There are people, myself included, who I didn't understand I had trouble reading because I didn't have trouble reading. I don't know how to describe that. I would be able to somehow do it. But when I really look at it, I would really literally have to read things over 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times as a kid. I don't know where my brain switched along the way, but because I could compensate without knowing I was doing it. In other words, people do that with their own eyesight. You know that. If you've had glasses, you had a time when you didn't have glasses. And so you navigated fine in your world. And to you, trees were just fuzzy green things. And they were lovely. So we have these little parts of ourselves. We compensate. Sometimes they do. You do well enough in school to kind of hide the disability. You don't think you're hiding it. You just, it's not showing up because you really do okay. So they don't excel in school. They're just kind of either average or maybe below average, but yet they're very gifted. This could be your child right now, and they may be tested for the part that's not doing well, or they may be pushed to say, we can make them go faster. We can make them go, you know, differently because they're not writing their name right, or they're not doing this right. Also, there's a myth that they always grow up to be successful. No, they don't, because they can have difficulty. Maybe they're afraid of success. Maybe they want just to have some friends and have a family, and they don't want to have all this stuff shine. They start talking to their peers and they lose their peers because they see too many details in the beautiful world around them. You have children like that. I know that. Sometimes they're risk takers. But sometimes they're the absolute reverse. They're inhibited because they see the 12 steps ahead. There are many children who won't join into the typical rough and tumble sports of the girls and the boys because they see how all this stuff works. So they can see, oh, if this person goes over here, they have already got the physics already worked out in their little snapshot brains. They don't know it. They're not doing physics. And so that causes them to want to maybe they seem paranoid or they seem too afraid because they see all these different aspects coming in. Also, the other part of it, again, is that it doesn't matter how much you push a child who doesn't have these gifts. They're not going to be something they're not. They are who they are, both ways, right? Maybe you want your child, just like that thing that I always remember, and I remember thinking about it when I heard it, and I don't know, maybe this guy is a complete genius, but I remember way back, I think it was Melissa Etheridge and David Crosby from Crosby, Stills & Nash were going to have, you know, a baby, and they were going to have a baby. I think it was through artificial insemination because their thought was they wanted to both have their musical genes put forth out into the world or something, or they would something about music. That's all I remember. And I remember thinking, all you got to do is look at history, that some of the most hideous people in the world who had, and then they had children who go down in infamy, doesn't mean their kids are going to do that. And conversely, some of the most, the Mozarts, the Beethovens, doesn't mean that their kids are going to end up being Mozart and Beethovens. And in fact, most likely they are not going to. They're different human beings. So we can't look into either the gifts or the non-gifts and say, if I just do X, Y, and Z, it's going to guarantee. And I know many a child prodigy who became a ne'er-do-well drug abuser because they were just driven too hard. And they didn't, that's not part, they wanted all of them to be accepted. The other things that get gifted kids are a breeze to raise. No, they are not, because you can't, you don't understand the struggles they have. You just know that they're struggling. Sometimes they can't pay attention because their mind is way off on how the light bulb works while you're trying to read them a story. And you don't even notice that you got the light bulb on. And they're wondering, I wonder how that big thing over there, how, you know, what is that? We can't know that, but there's pressure to be normal. Pressure to be normal. They can't be, they feel like misfits, and in a way they really are. So you have to remember that, and you can also have all things at once. Could they have the exact symptoms of ADHD? Yes. How about obsessive compulsive disorder? Yes, because they line all these things up and they're busy going, oh, all the blues have to stay with blues, all the reds have to stay with reds. And perhaps it's not something that's going to give them dysfunction. Perhaps they're just in this pattern orientation of their mental development at the time. So remember that sometimes it can be a vicious cycle. We're in the dark ages when it comes to understanding this stuff. And if you remember that, it can liberate you. So when we come back, I'm going to get back to the two other things I was talking about, perfectly normal, and this very famous person who's had a lifelong battle with mental illness, when we get back.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world. You're listening to Dr. Michelle Live. Dr. Michelle is a Catholic psychiatrist. However, the views and opinions presented by Dr. Michelle are by no means medical advice. Please consult your doctor for official medical guidance.
Well, welcome back. I am your host, Dr. Michelle. You are with me on Dr. Michelle Live, and I am rushing through all this stuff, hoping to get this in before the close. As always, I run out of time, so I will take up tomorrow what I don't get to today. But let's go to Perfectly Normal. Perfectly Normal is the op-ed piece that I read today from the New York Times. And it's beautiful. And it was weird because I was actually looking at something else and it just popped up and it was like, wow, thank you. It just fit perfectly into today. So this is it's a little video. It's only, I think it's 12 minutes long, and it's so worth watching. I have the link to both the article and the video for you on the show notes page. All you have to do is log on to breadboxmedia.podbean.com and you will find it. And this is written by Joris Dibigi. I don't know how to say the name. I really apologize to Joris, but it is D-E-B as in boy, E. Oh, I think that's an I-J, not a J-I. Okay. So I don't know. Dibigi. So anyway, this is about a man named Jordan, and he is a man who lives in Los Angeles. He I'm reading a little bit of what they say, but anyway, he has Asperger's syndrome, which you can look up. It is now, as I said, oftentimes just put into the autistic spectrum. And so he can go from isolation to chaos to, but he does work, does very repetitive work. Also in this video, you'll hear him play piano, which is pretty awesome. So I'm going to just scroll down to a little place where she talks about autism and Asperger's, which now I think are kind of lumped together in the spectrum. She says, or he says, autism and Asperger's syndrome, which is often considered a high-functioning form of autism, can manifest through a wide spectrum of symptoms. And usually the people are very socially awkward, not always, but sometimes they can just, they strike you as very different, very odd, kind of like, you know, just it's an extreme phenomena anyway. And, in fact, I know another, family member in my, my ex-husband's family who has Asperger's, and as a little tiny child, very unusual, zero eye contact, zero, absolute inability, no connections. Not that they're cold, unfeeling people. They just don't, they don't connect with that emotion. So they don't know why someone's crying. And as he got older, he had very unusual taste and characteristics and interests. Like he had a collection of lighters and, just odd things like that. And when my mother-in-law, who was not ex then, when she died, he was there and his participation was handing Kleenex to everyone who was weeping. But he himself did not weep. It didn't mean he didn't love her. So, you know, things that we don't understand. And then as he got older, his genius in one area got him a job that, unfortunately for the other people, he didn't know this was going to happen. He just naturally did the work of five people. So they didn't need those five people. He was very brilliant in one area, found someone he was compatible with, wonderful woman, beautiful, had a learning disability herself, and a very smart, accomplished person, and had, I think they have two children now, and just happy as clams at high tide and very successful. This says, in Jordan's case, he lives independently, holds a job, and manages his own personal finances. She's talking about how you can have a wide variety of symptoms, and they can manifest in different ways from severity, including extremely difficult for the person and people who fit in a little bit better into the norm of society, the bell curve of society. So talks about how this gentleman has a relationship with a woman named Tony, who herself, I think she's got Tourette's, they said, multiple disabilities. But he's, more importantly, he is self-aware, self-accepting, caring, and with a strong ability to analyze and speak about his condition with others. He understands how he is different, and he has created a coping mechanism for himself that enables him to function in society and pursue his interest in the arts as an escape when it all becomes too much for him. So that's why he plays piano and writes songs. It is these qualities that I wanted to emphasize in this film. I wanted Jordan himself to tell us his story instead of it being formulated out of impressions from the perspective of an outsider. A strong self-advocate, Jordan argues that he is not a disabled person, but merely a person with a disability. Someone from whom those he calls normal people could learn. Besides, he will argue, everybody is not completely normal anyway. So much more research and support is needed to enable people with autism. There are no limits to what beautiful minds like Jordan's can help us make of this world. All right. So I'm going to ask Alex how much time I have to see if I can get into this other one today. I want you to all log on to it. I've only got 5 minutes. I'm not positive I can get to this. This is called Only the Lonely. We have a link to it. This is by a gentleman named Stephen Fry, who is a very famous man. Many of you know him. British. You'd recognize his face. He's been in movies. He writes movies. He's a comic. He's had his own shows. He played the role of Jeeves in Jeeves and Wooster, which was a long playing thing on television. He's written books. He's written a book called The Secret Life of, The Secret Life. I don't think it was a book. The Secret Life of the Manic Depressive, because he has manic, bipolar disorder now we call it. He's a fascinating human being, and he came from a very, very, very difficult background. And it was during a time when he was in prison at some point. He had grandparents who were killed in Auschwitz, and other aunts and cousins who also were a very, very tough upbringing. And he flunked out of tons of stuff, and he's super famous. But his article on his own Stephen Fry website is called Only the Lonely, written in 2013, which I'll read part of it now, and then tomorrow we can look at it. And it says, there isn't any point in denying that the outburst of sympathy and support that followed my confession to an attempt at self-slaughter last year has touched me deeply. I guess he might have tried even to commit suicide. I don't know. It starts out, though, some people, as some people always will, cannot understand that depression, or in my case, cyclothymia, a form of bipolar disorder, is an illness, and they are themselves perhaps the sufferers of a malady that one might call either an obsession with money or a woeful lack of imagination. Then he says, how can someone so well off, this was quoted by an article about him. It said, how can someone so well off, well known and successful have depression? They will ask. Then he said that Alistair Campbell, in a marvelous article, suggested changing the word depression to cancer or diabetes in order to reveal how, in its own way, sick a question like that is. It's ill-natured, ill-informed, ill-willed, or just plain ill. It's hard to say. But most people, a surging, warm, caring majority, have been kind, almost too kind. There's something a little flustering and embarrassing when a taxi driver shakes you by the hand, looks deeply into your eyes and says, you look after yourself, mate. Yes, promise me. And there's something perhaps not too helpful to one's mental health when it is only the subject people want to talk about to you anyway, however kindly and for whatever reason. We're not going to have time to go into all this, but I will read a couple more paragraphs. And he says, but I have nothing to complain about. I won't go into the terrible details of the bottle of vodka, the mixture of pills, and the closeness to permanent oblivion I came. You can only imagine them, and I don't want to upset the poor TV producer and the hotel staff who have had to break down my door to find me in the unconscious state I was in. Four broken ribs, thanks to my sort of convulsive fit that must have overtaken me while I was laying almost comatose. He said, you can picture the scene. The episode, plus the relationship I now have with a magnificent psychiatrist, has made my mental health better, I think, than it has ever, ever been. I used to think it utterly normal that I suffered from suicidal ideation on almost a daily basis. In other words, for as long as I can remember, the thought of ending my life came to me frequently and obsessively. But then, it's the thought behind the most famous speech in all history, to be or not to be. And then he quotes it, and I might start there tomorrow. He quotes Shakespeare, to be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis noble in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, and them, to die to sleep, no more, and by a sleep to say that we end. Now I'm going to look at that more, not only Shakespeare, but what this amazingly famous, funny, hilarious, talented man who had a very sketchy past and who himself is saying, yeah, I have bipolar disorder. Let's take a look. We're going to look at that tomorrow. I am your host, Dr. Michelle. Have a beautiful, wonderful rest of your day. God bless, and see you tomorrow.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.